Welcome to the Who Cares podcast, brought to you by the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences and the College of Education at Georgia Southern University.
Welcome back to Who Cares. Ryan and I are pleased to bring you Dr. Rami Haddad, who is an associate professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering in the Alan E. Paulson College of Engineering and Computing at Georgia Southern University. And Rami is an electrical engineer that I know and work with, but he does so many other things. Some of the interesting stuff that he's been working on lately is brain-computer interface and smart technology. And we've been having a conversation a little bit about what smart technology means. So let's start there. What is smart technology?
Smart technology is technology that does allow you to obtain information, process the information, and obtain some useful outcome out of this information. That's what we refer to as smart. We usually do it as human beings. For instance, as a faculty, when I grade a test, I look at a solution for a problem. I have to follow through the line of thought and assess how good it was. This requires some level of intelligence. Other things, you know, you go to a doctor, you have a chest x-ray, the doctor gets the chest x-ray and look at it, say, you know, you have pneumonia or you do not have a pneumonia. That requires some level of intelligence. This comes through a lot of years of training, getting the right certificates to be able to do this task. Now, what we're trying to do with the smart technology is to be able to leverage artificial neural networks where we can mimic the way the brain works by training these networks to perform a certain task and test it by doing that. We can use it to classify x-ray images to see if we have any diagnosis for any illness. We can use that to identify issues with camera systems. Now we apply a lot of cameras everywhere and for surveillance purposes, and it's going to take a lot of manpower having each person assigned to monitor the video feed for a camera or a few. Now we can do that automatically through a computing system, and it can handle all the feeds for all the cameras, which helps make this possible. And that's through AI or artificial intelligence.
Okay, so in this particular case, since I come from an education background, we have a certain view of intelligence and we always think of the word smart in terms of what do you know? But this artificial intelligence is just, it's just a thing until we tell it, we give it the smarts. It's almost like we send it to school. This is what we want you to learn.
Exactly. So when you want to develop a smart application using artificial intelligence, you're going to have to first build the neural structure of this artificial. It contains layers and different things. We're not going to get into the technical aspect of it, but the most critical part is actually training this network. And that happens through the process of you feeding it information and telling it, I want you to learn that this feature looks like this through this signal, and that feature is this. And you send a lot of data into it, in a way that you can get it to develop this knowledge. And it does develop this knowledge by setting certain parameters for these neural networks, and those parameters becomes the knowledge in a sense. Now, after I finish training it, I can send it data within the scope of what it was trained to do, and actually this network will be able to perform the task it was delegated to do. So it's like a human. You send them to school, you train them to do something, and then they become experts at it. And as you know, with experience, become more knowledgeable. The same thing with these networks. If they're adaptive, they can keep learning as they're performing tasks and become better and better. And you can also scale the network. Now you probably heard of artificial intelligence and neural networks. Now there's something called deep learning. Mm-hmm. And deep learning are technically artificial intelligence or neural networks that are much bigger than the normal ones that we've been using before. And this allows them to do a lot more complicated tasks, mimicking something more closer to what the brain can do, in a sense.
So, but it's still just neural networks and computer coding is still just a series of zeros and ones. It's a yes or a no. We're not developing critical thinking skills. It's just doing the task we've assigned it.
It goes beyond that. Okay. It goes beyond that. Now, there are a lot of research in different areas. Now we have neural networks that are designed to write, designed to draw. And, you know, there are a lot of things that we even compose music, believe it or not. And they can do things that a human being cannot achieve unless they are really, really talented, like Mozart's and the most famous composers. And that's something that is very interesting. It goes beyond just ones and zeros and yes or no, in a sense. That's one application of it. But you can take images and now predict how a person would look when they're old. Mm-hmm. And that's through training them on different features of different people, how they aged through life, and you can get a really good approximation that's used in a lot of investigations. For instance, if you have people that you're looking for and it's been a while, you can also predict how their look could change in a sense with time. So there are a lot of uses for it.
I'm seeing a lot of applications, and I guess I was thinking more of like an ethical dilemma or a critical decision that had to be made based on the data, maybe based one way on a computer's understanding of, say, law and public domain and ethics, whereas it's not that clear cut in the human world. So there's some things that a computer would never, or AI would never take over for us, potentially. But what is the biggest application of this? Where is it being used the most? Do we know?
At this point, it's heavily used in images and videos, just for the fact that this type of data is not simple to deal with on a day-to-day basis. A lot of applications have been incorporated, and we're using AI that requires classification of images and video feeds and things like that, just because we don't have the manpower to keep looking. Let's say you want to search a video for a specific feature in it. Let's say you're searching for something in that video. Rather than having somebody sit and watch the footage, you can send it through a computer and it will process it way faster than what we can spend watching it and obtain this feature, and if it exists or not. So there's a lot of this application being used in research. It's heavily used now, and a lot of applications are actually being developed as we speak that leverage AI. It's one of the hottest areas in research.
Great. So in this line of work, both the smart technology as well as the brain-computer interface, I think there's going to be a lot of people who are skeptical or fearful of what it is that you're doing. I think the argument probably comes down to the slippery slope. Like, if we can become more efficient by looking for a specific image in a video feed, that's one thing. I think there's going to be concerns about surveillance and then, computers taking over what humans do now. And I'm kind of curious how you'd respond to that.
And that's very true. There's nothing that we can do to deny that. It is reality. Let's take an example. We have autonomous vehicles now becoming closer to reality. Now, if you think about it, if you have an autonomous vehicle, there's no need for a driver. If you don't need a driver, there's a lot of jobs that depends on the drivers. Trucking business, moving people for transport, those can be done autonomously. So a whole line of work would be taken over by a computer that has ability to perform the task, in a sense. And that's very true. And I think the nature of how jobs is going to evolve with time, they're going to become more technical, in a sense, and more skill related than what it used to be. And if you go through time, at the beginnings, we barely were focused on hunting and obtaining food and doing basic things. And as time progressed, the type of jobs evolved, and that natural evolution with the technology is going to continue. It's actually going to accelerate, if you ask me. And you know, that's an issue. Another thing that is being developed using AI is department stores and retail. Recently, Amazon tested with opening a store that you don't really have to have anybody that can check you out. You know, you just pick up whatever you want from the store, and they have cameras and they identify you, and they will automatically put the transaction in. You pick up the item and leave the store without even talking to anybody. And that's if that become a reality, then, you know, the nature of having people as tellers would also change. So yes, change will be inevitable in that sense.
It's a little scary.
It is, it is. I don't think it's going to happen at, you know, tomorrow or in the next 5 or 10 years. It's going to take time to, you know, be incorporated, but eventually it will. And I, as far as I can see, how we evolve from not leveraging any devices and not being dependent on the internet in the early 1990s, and how we now function entirely over the internet. This change is going to happen sooner or later.
Well, I think about when I go to the grocery store right now, I can go self-checkout, I can go to McDonald's, and I can order on a kiosk and never actually have to speak with anybody. And yes, it's convenience, but at the same time, I might not talk to anybody an entire day just doing my normal errands. And that's kind of bothersome. I mean, you know, with the pandemic especially, we learned what it was like to not talk to people. But yes. Now we're getting more comfortable with this idea of talking to folks via computers. So I'm wondering, like you said, if this is just a natural progression.
And the sad part is from a social perspective nowadays, if I have kids and I see how they are attached to their devices, and they rather use a device to communicate than having a human to human kind of communication, which is scary in a way. Personally, I like the human interaction, but in the new generation, they might not mind talking to a device rather than a human being, which is not a good thing. So
during the pandemic, there was some research that showed that people were communicating by text message within their own home. And the answer, the question as to why, is that that felt normal to them, right?
Well, I will admit, being lazy, and I asked my husband via text message to bring me a soda the other day. Because he was in the kitchen. Why not? But, you know, the other side of this is I can see where, especially for people who are suffering from a disability or an impairment of some kind, or even our elderly, could really benefit from this type of interaction that gives them more freedom.
Absolutely, absolutely. For instance, driving. You know, if you're elderly or you have a certain disability, that might not be something that is easily accomplished. But with a self-driving vehicle, then you don't really have to worry about being the one commanding this vehicle. You can rely on the technology to facilitate that. So for every technology, there's advantages and disadvantages, obviously, and you know, and if it's leveraged for the benefit of the society and used properly, I think it serves a purpose. But you know, you're right.
So that brings me to my ultimate question here. I think we've been kind of tiptoeing around it, but the podcast is called Who Cares? And so I'm curious if you can speak to your ultimate goals. What do you hope to achieve out of this work? And what impact will it have on our culture?
Yeah, I can answer that question by just going to the basis of what engineers are. Engineers are problem solvers that takes abstract math and physics theories and come up with solutions that serve humanity. And in a sense, every single human being should be concerned about the technologies coming out. They should be interested in knowing what they can do to solve problems that they face on a day-to-day basis that can help facilitate life. And I think with the technology we develop and how fast it's becoming reality and used on a day-to-day basis, people should follow what the engineers and scientists are coming up with at this point, just to keep up with the future. And you know, if you're a student and you're trying to figure out what you want to do in the future, you might look into the prospect of how things are evolving in that field and plan for it accordingly, and that could help.
So your work is developed really around using these technologies and the mathematical formulas to help people do something.
Yes, I mean, as an engineer, we're problem solvers. We try to solve a problem in a very optimal way, leveraging the science and math and all the tools that we have in our disposal, in a sense, to develop these solutions. And we've been doing it for a while.
So I think people have this image of the daily life of an engineer. You know, you're in your lab and you're constantly fiddling with things. But what I'm hearing from this particular and the outcomes that you're looking for is that you're really having to work interdisciplinarily across fields, because I'm not sure how much, you know, brain-based psychology you ever had in study. And so what does a typical day look like for you when you're looking at these devices?
You're right. And the most interesting problems are the cross-disciplinary problems nowadays, and that's absolutely true. We had to learn. We had to sit and read a lot of literature, find research, and get knowledgeable in the area that we are venturing in. And by all means, we have talked before with other people and collaborated with others that are more experts in the area that we are trying to leverage this technology in. And that's the nature of how engineers work nowadays. If you go to any industry, you'll see that your team has a lot of people from different backgrounds, just because that's what's needed. A single person cannot work in a silo to be a one-man show like what it used to be. The nature of problems and systems are becoming more complicated, that requires this kind of teamwork.
Okay, awesome.
Fascinating.
So I mean, I'm just fascinated by this, and in all of our conversations, I keep thinking of somebody like Stephen Hawking, who it was very evident that he was using a brain-computer interface. But from what you have said, it seems like we're going to take that a step farther, to where he's not just communicating with a computer, or she's not communicating with a computer, but rather giving directions to maybe a robotic appendage or to a light switch or to something else that actually does a task.
Absolutely, yes. And that's what we're hoping that we can achieve with that. And a lot of things that have been done already, we were able to do a lot of interesting things, controlling motions of arms and things like that currently with the research, and even controlling devices. We have been able to facilitate that as well.
So this really could be a wonderful humanitarian progress, I guess is the best way to put it.
Absolutely, yes.
I mean, the implications, I think, you know, in my head, I kind of go with Ryan, like, people are going to be kind of nervous about this when it becomes more commonplace. I think everyone would be fine with something that is going to help someone succeed. But when it becomes where now I have to monitor my smartphone usage or my home usage, because who knows who can control it outside of me, it's becomes scary and difficult. And our young people coming up are so much more comfortable with this technology than we are.
Yeah, so when I use Google, for example, and I'm putting in a search term, it always seems to know exactly how I want to finish that.
And yes.
That kind of freaks me out. That's probably based in some of the smart technologies that you're working on. But if there was something reading my brain and all I had to do was look in a camera and it would know what I'm thinking, what I want to search, that's scary to me. I think that's going to be scary for a lot of people. But knowing that this technology is going toward that purpose of really helping to improve the lives of people makes me feel better.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, there are artificial intelligence in forming sentences and putting things that you know, search engines are actually using right now. It's not doing it through camera and reading your brain, but you're right. Yeah.
But in the future, we could get to that.
We could get to that.
It might. I mean, impossible is a matter of perspective, you know.
That's true.
And we can, we never expected to be able to do what we do now, and it's reality. So the future is interesting. Let's put it this way.
Yeah, and I mean, from a socio-educational status perspective, I think, the more we have computers that are writing our sentences and doing our algorithms, what are we losing? What neural connections are we making to stay one step ahead of the computer? If the computer can do everything for us, why do I need to go to school?
And that's a good point. I think we should not rely entirely on devices. These devices need to be trained, need to have some form of validation that experts are the only people that can actually do that. So, in another research we're doing, we're using AI to help diagnose pneumonia in patients using X-rays, and which is one of the things that is very obvious now with the pandemic and the COVID-19 being a major cause for pneumonia, since we, to help radiologists focus on the most important cases, we can use that as a first stage in diagnosing this, and run all these X-rays through these neural networks and obtain the results, and then we can prioritize the work of the radiologist based on what we think is important. But I don't think we should get rid of these professionals, because that's not a good thing.
Right. That's interesting, because when we teach statistics in the social sciences, you know what the number means. That's part of what we learn. But then you have to understand the context. You have to be creative about what's not in that model, and then you have to think about what it means overall for a specific phenomenon. And I don't think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we're anywhere close to that level of cognition being coded into a computer system.
Yes, absolutely not. I think the human brain is still the most, the smartest thing that we actually know. And, you know, computers can do things faster, a little bit more efficient in certain areas, but it does not compare to a human.
And again, I think it's the knowledge and the experiences that go along with interpreting the data, that it's not always black or white. There's subtle nuances and shades of gray in everything that we do as a human that
yes.
The computer is not going to know.
That's true. Especially at this point, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
It will be interesting to see where we go, because the older I get, the less computers I want. But then, and as we think about, you know, a computer that could take my neural commands and reach something for me that maybe as I get older I can't reach, that's kind of exciting to me. So where is that line? Who knows?
Yeah, you're right. I think it's going to be, we're going to be more dependent on these devices. They're becoming more efficient, faster. And with that being said, we're adding more intelligence, and intelligence requires processing. And since this is improving, then everything else will improve with it. So I see it increasing, unfortunately. So I'm not going to be able to make it easy on you, but
get used to it.
Well, I have a choice now.
Yes.
It is not so prolific that I can't, if I chose to put my phone down and walk away, I can still do that right now. Now, my life would be completely disrupted, because not even for social media, but my calendar and everything else is on that phone, but I can walk away from it as an option. I don't know that in the future we're going to be able to, because that's how, especially in rural areas, you might be communicating with your doctor.
Yes. And take the pandemic as an example. I mean, even if you were not a tech savvy person or had the choice of avoiding technology as much as possible, you were forced to actually use it to its fullest potential. I mean, we were doing Zoom meetings. I mean, we're not meeting. So you're going to have to use a device and be comfortable with it. I personally have seen some of the older people in my family that never did that, and now they are expert in doing it just because the need presented itself, and they kind of had to cope with the need and use it. So there will be certain circumstances that probably will be put in that requires us to develop that knowledge, and you know, and this is something it's hard to avoid, let's put it this way.
Yeah, it is.
And I think some of this is going to stay with us. I mean, I guess that's just my opinion, but telehealth, for example,
yes,
has just been so convenient for so many people that I don't see that going away. And so you're going to need that phone from time to time, Kanya.
Yes, you are right. No, and again, the benefits at this point in time far outweigh the risks for me. If Google or Amazon wants to know that I was looking at bagels the other day and wants to say, hey, don't make your own, buy these, that's fine with me. It's a little scary sometimes with some of the stuff I look up for work and stuff, and then it tags me and I'm like, I don't want that. But again, it can't make that decision that, oh, that was a work-related thing and this is a home-related thing. It's all one to it.
Yes, yes. At this point it is, but, you know.
Maybe in the future.
Yeah, I think, you know, with search engines and the way they actually work and how they actually get to tag your information that you're searching and referring it to you personally and send targeted advertisement is something that has been going, but it's kind of got on a bigger scale now just because there's a lot of money into it, and that's how these companies make their money. You know, you're using a Google search, you're not paying for it, but what they're doing is they're actually using cookies to, you know what kind of things you like and track it and try to send you targeted messaging, which ends up profiting them. And, you know, we have options and how we can turn that off if we need to, too.
And I think that's the benefit that keeps everybody sort of calm, is that you have options to turn off tracking, and you have options. I mean, there are always going to be some level of tracking. But, you know, I think about the smartwatches as well, and I think, what if you ate something that was not so good for you, but, you know, was really delicious, and, you know, your blood pressure went up or whatever? You know, at what point does it start contacting the doctor for you? Mm-hmm. And saying, hey.
I think based on Rami's research here, if we get to that point where it can read the brain, it could know that you're at home and that, you know, what we talk about, you know, switching off work and turning on home life. That might be more of a reality, just the way that the brain works. And that way, maybe Google would know that you're at home instead of at work, and give you those suggestions for home stuff versus work stuff.
I think they can, they know that as well now, because, you know, information are sent through networks, and networks are technically located in a sense. So there will be, you know, that's something that they can do. I don't know if they do it or not. I'm not going to speak to that. But, you know, yeah, this is not too difficult.
And I think we have a while before we get to a completely, you know, all-encompassing. I mean, to me, the technology is so much more helpful than it is a hindrance right now.
Yeah.
And especially for those people who need it. And mm-hmm. It sounds like where we're taking the technology is just going to make a level playing field for everyone to have equal access, which is what we want.
True. True. But, you know, at the other hand, if you look at a situation when you lose power, can you function? If you ask yourself that question and see if your answer is no, then you are 100% dependent on technology.
Yeah. Rami, I ran a department of sociology at a different university for a number of years, and we had a power outage or an internet outage. And I started walking around the office to see what people were doing, and people had zero idea what they should be doing without electricity or internet. They just kind of wandered around the halls aimlessly. It was really telling what happens when our use of these technologies is not possible.
And if you think about it, 30 years ago, we were functioning without it. Mm-hmm. And we were functioning perfectly. We got rid of, you know, plan B, in a sense, when it comes mm-hmm. to how we do things.
But it is telling to watch people when the internet goes down, or, you know, it just happened in my office. I was in the middle of typing an email, and I got a little thing that said, whoops, lost connection. I'm just steady banging away trying to figure out why it lost connection. But it's who we have become. I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing because we are now making connections with family and friends that we would have lost connection with in the past.
True.
Now, there's always people you don't want to have a connection with. But, you know, it's a give and take with everything.
Yes.
Well, I'd just like to point out we're in a room where when we were undergraduates, I would assume most of us didn't have the internet or email.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you want information, you had to go to the library, find it. You cannot Google it. It wasn't something at that time, and it was...
We had a card catalog when I was in
there. And something as simple as you missing a class, you can't just email somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go tell them in person. And
Yes, everything was different.
Well, and it was a lot less easy to be found, mm-hmm. by your parents and that kind of thing. You could say, I'm going to my friend's house, and you might start there and end up somewhere else, but now people can track you on the phones and everything. Again, not a bad thing. Because it does help keep our kids safe. But yes. At the same time, it's kind of like, I don't need you to know where I am all the time.
That's true. I mean, for everything, everything has two sides to it.
Right. But again, you know, taking it back to the smart idea of it, the computer doesn't know whether it's ethical or not to locate me. It's just doing exactly what we've programmed it to do.
Yes.
And so without that human interface, the brain interface, the program or the computer or the chip or whatever is just going to sit there.
Absolutely.
So it's not going to learn. It can learn in a sense, but it's not taking that information necessarily and applying it to new situations all the time.
Unless it's trained to do that.
Right. So, but again, it's not making that decision. So when we think about smart in terms of these technologies, we've got to remember that the technology is only as smart as the human who created it.
Absolutely.
It can be trained and to do things faster, which is great convenience, but it's not necessarily going to outsmart us.
It can outperform us in certain tasks, but I don't think it's going to outsmart us. I mean, you can think of it if you want to search a word in a document with 500 pages. If you're going to go through it manually, it's going to take you a lot of time. Mm-hmm. Computers can function faster, but if you're trying to... create something, it's easier for you to do it than what a computer can, and you can probably do a better job than what the computer can do. So the creativity aspect of things that humans have cannot be replaced with a computer.
It'll pick up the 5,000 uses of the word smart, but not all the nuanced language uses of the word smart
that we could possibly use. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, it sounds really interesting. I'd love to have you back.
Absolutely.
Tell us how things are going. But in the meantime, we really appreciate your time and wish you the best of luck in your research and hope you come back and see us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you, guys.
Really.
This has been Who Cares? Casual conversations with Southern scholars, brought to you by the College of Behavioral and Social Sciences and the College of Education at George Southern University. The opinions expressed here are those of the researchers and the host and not of Georgia Southern University or the University System of Georgia. We would like to give a shout out to Purple Planet for our bumper music. Join us next time for Who Cares? Casual conversations with Southern scholars. Who Cares? Casual conversations with Southern scholars.